Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This presentation by Lisa Cressman is titled, How to Preach in Uncertain Times.
I am grateful. I'm grateful for you doing the jobs that you are, for proclaiming the good news at a time none of us ever expected to be claiming it in. None of us was prepared for this when we went to our respective training places. And you are the ones who are proclaiming good news that people need to hear, even when they think it's not the news they need, it's not the news they want to hear, but it is always good news. So that's what we're going to talk about today, is how to be preaching good news that people aren't quite prepared to hear. How do we proclaim it in these uncertain times? So Ben, if I could ask you to put up the first slides, please. So how to preach in these uncertain times, and this is, if you could go to the next slide, based on my book that's here in Working Preacher Books, Fortress Press, that is available to all of you as well. Next slide, please. So what we'll be doing today is I want to help identify the reasons that listeners find these times challenging and what constitutes a challenging sermon. We're going to talk about how preaching that death is expected, but so is resurrection. Then we'll have some conversation. Then we're going to turn to the craft of preaching itself to help you gain some tools, I hope, that will help you craft sermons that you can apply to preaching the gospel in these uncertain days. And then we'll have a bit more conversation and perhaps some ways to follow up. Now, next. So what makes preaching in these uncertain times so challenging? We know that people are so much on edge. People are coming into church or whatever constitutes your online worship these days. They're often walking in with sort of a chip on their shoulders already. They're waiting to be challenged in a way that they don't appreciate, or they're waiting to be comforted. And if neither of those happens, there can be some reactions. So what I want to suggest today is that preaching in uncertain times is not challenging so much because of the news cycles. It's not because of partisan politics. It's not because of pandemics. It's not because of the issues of the day. Next, please. The problem is that challenging times threaten what we value. The times we're in threaten the things that are important to us. And we are in this extraordinary time, this perfect storm of multiple concurrent threats to the things that we value. Next, please. We think we shouldn't have to grieve. There should be a way around death. And yet the truth is, we as a nation and as a world are slowly gathering on a Golgotha filled with crosses. Because in so many ways, life as we have known it is over. It's finished, it's dying out, it's in transition. We don't know what's ahead. So let's talk some about specifically what is being threatened. Next slide, please. So what are we talking about? What sorts of things? Well, some of the things that are dying out, things that are changing, that we value greatly, are the things that sort of make life normal, for example. And this was true even before the pandemic. We miss our functions. We miss our roles. We miss our why, the reason we get out of bed in the mornings. We miss our contributions to our social networks, going to our jobs. The people who are members of our congregations miss the things that they do at church. They miss being a regular part of the Altar Guild, or working in the kitchen, or greeting people on Sundays, or helping to prepare those bulletins, going out to meet shut-ins. Those are their roles. and they miss them. But again, the church was changing before the pandemic. The church is changing dramatically. Many of us see that we are entering into a second reformation. We don't know what the church 50 and 100 years from now is going to look like. And so a lot of our roles, including our own, we as clergy, our roles are also in question. It's also true for people's roles at work. People are shifting now to working at home. They're missing a lot of their social functions that they have at work. Kids are missing being at school and sports. They're missing their clubs at school. They're missing church youth groups. The ways that people contribute on a daily basis is changing and has changed dramatically, and there's no end in sight. Next slide, please. Another thing that is changing or has changed are our systems. These are all threatened as well. Again, pre-pandemic as well as now. We cannot live without systems. We can't. We depend completely on them. It's what makes life function for the masses as well as within our own households. We depend on systems of government and hospitals and banking. We depend on the system of rules and regs that stop signs are there at intersections for a reason so that people stop so we don't get into accidents. We depend on our church systems, the way things work on a daily basis. We depend on our systems at home. And so in the pandemic, when everybody is at home, it's all topsy-turvy and we've had to learn new systems. We can't live without them. The church as a system is in transition. Our governments and hospitals also. One of the big fears with COVID-19 as our hospitals were filling up is, wasn't there going to be any room for me if I got sick? What if you had a stroke and the hospital was full of COVID-19 patients? Is the system prepared to handle all of us? In addition, our government is very much under threat right now. Democracy, many believe, is hanging by a thread. We don't know what that means if that were to change dramatically. So we are in a time of uncertainty with our systems. And when our systems feel like they have failed or we are afraid they might, it rocks us to our cores. So these contribute to some of the uncertain times we are living in and we preach into. In addition, Ben, could you back up, please? One other system I want to name. It's not just the formal systems that are at stake. We also rely on informal systems, like how do we look out for each other? Informal systems like common courtesy. Informal systems like having some sense that we agree on what constitutes a fact. When those systems that we have all agreed to abide by have been tossed up in the air, then of course people are feeling like their way of life is threatened. All right, now next one. Thank you. Our livelihoods also feel threatened. With the economy in trouble because of COVID-19, there are a lot of ways in which our lives and livelihoods feel precarious. It's especially not so easy right now to pick up and move across the country if even a new job is available. And this trickles down to us as well as clergy, because if the economy changes, then charitable giving also gets to be in question. What does that mean for the future of the church? What does that mean for the future of our roles as providers, as leaders in that church system? Our livelihoods also are being questioned. Next, please. Relationships. This is huge. We are not built for social isolation. I'm not telling you anything new there. When our relationships feel like they are threatened, when they are at risk, then that puts us very much on edge. But it's not only relationships we have with people, it's also relationships we have with things, with ideas, with symbols. That's part of what makes a natural disaster, for example, so devastating. When people have a house fire, for example, one of the questions we ask is, did you save your pictures? Did you save your photos? Because our photos represent our lives, our histories. They represent our relationships. They represent that we are here. So when there are questions to things like changes in the church, it's our relationship with the people at church. It can affect our relationship with the clergy, and it can affect our relationship with God. That's why painting the question of what color to paint the sanctuary walls can be so fraught with emotion. It's because it feels like it can be messing with your relationship with God. It can be absolutely devastating for some. This doesn't have to be rational. It just has to feel like something somebody says or what's happening in the culture is threatening something that matters dearly to me. Next slide, please. Another one of the storms that we are preaching into is our well-being. And this, our well-being has to do with our capacity to care for ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. The pandemic has put this into question in whole new ways. We want to take care of our well-being, of course, but this is put at risk when other people aren't protecting our well-being by wearing a mask. Our well-being feels threatened when other people don't have common courtesy to protect us from a deadly virus. Beyond that, there are also things that this pandemic is and has threatened, things like travel, being able to go on vacation, being able to have something that we look forward to, having something on the schedule of the next concert we get to go to, or being able to travel out of town, even not that far away, to go somewhere with family, friends, to gather for birthday parties. All of that is part of our well-being, because all of that has been attacked with the pandemic. People are feeling that sense of loss. Next, please. And this is the crux of it, our identity. We know who we are in relation to all of the things I've just listed. It's how we identify ourselves. When somebody asks you to introduce yourself, if you're like me, you probably introduce yourself saying something like your name, and then where do you live, whether you're married, what your job is, do you have children, maybe a few things you enjoy doing. All of those things describe a relationship with someone or something else. We know ourselves only in relation to the people and things that matter to us. And it's not only our people, it's our ideas, our expectations, our hopes, our dreams, the way we thought things were going to turn out. When people say, I don't recognize X, Y, or Z, fill in the blank, what they're reflecting on is, I don't see myself in the current picture. I thought I would. I thought I knew how things were going to go. I thought I knew how I fit in. But when something shifts around me, now I have to recalibrate and figure out who I am in the midst of what is happening around me. So, for example, there are questions about what our roles are going to be as church leaders in the next while. With the economy changing, with online giving, with online services rather, with charitable giving perhaps changing, well, we know ourselves as preachers, as clergy, as church leaders. If that goes away, well, then who are we? Do we become sort of quasi lay people sitting back in the pews again or watching online? What's our identity without that? What is our understanding of what this country is about? When anybody talks about American values or your state's values, they are obliquely referencing, pulling up what we understand the identity of the culture we are in and our place in it. If those things change, we have to adjust who we are in relation to it. It's not always for the bad. There are some things, a lot of things in this country, for example, that desperately need to change. For example, that this is a white majority power culture. That's got to change. That's an identity that needs never to have been born and should be jettisoned forthwith. But that doesn't mean there isn't going to be a transition and a painful process to adjust to what is coming, to what needs to come. Understanding who we are is in relation to all of these grand ideas and our place in the midst of it. When any of that changes, it messes with who am I? When we are placing our identity in places other than primarily as children of God, and then those identities begin to shift when the terrain around us shifts, then of course we start reacting. We are experiencing loss. Something we value is dying, or it is being threatened by, we perceive it is being threatened by someone or something else. We get scared and we don't like it and we want it to stop. So we start reacting. Next slide, please. So these are some common responses to actual or perceived or anticipated losses. And remember, these losses don't have to be, they don't have to have happened already. They can be ones that we only perceive could happen, and they might be losses we fear will happen in the future. Any of these, however, can prompt these kind of common reactions. Next, please. The first one is looking back, nostalgia. How many people are still vocalizing in that the way that the church can be saved is by bringing back families and children as the way to save the church? It's because they're imagining this sort of glory time in the past of the way church used to be. It's really hard to come to terms with, it's not going to happen again. We're not going back. We're not going back to a mythical time in the past that is going to look again as our future. It's not happening. That's painful. When people talk about make America great again, that is also bringing up a mythologized, romanticized past that's never defined. Nobody ever says what great are people talking about. It's never defined because the idea is to bring up a longing for a mythical past, an emotional reaction that people believe they can't live without. Trying to bring back some kind of a past and put it into a future context. It's not going to happen. Next, please. Another thing that people can do when they are feeling that what they value is threatened is we get crabby. When we're feeling anxious or sad or vulnerable, people lash out. The blog post that I published today is on exactly this topic and how one preacher did a marvelous job at addressing that, the way that people were lashing out at him for being too quote-unquote political and for engaging in Black Lives Matter. Now, conversely, people can also isolate and walk away, and we may never know why, but lashing out is one of the common ways we deal with our losses or fear of loss. Next, please. We also can be possessed by the demon of fear. We feel scared and anxious. We feel this unidentifiable angst. And we are, generally speaking, an emotionally illiterate people. We don't know what we're feeling. We only know there's something happening and we feel ill at ease. And we don't know what to do to fix it. We hate being in transition from what we've known to not knowing what's ahead. 40 years in the desert without a map, with some promise of milk and honey at the end of it. And by the way, milk and honey for whom? Who's controlling the milk and honey? Who says who's going to get it? All of those senses raise up and continue to raise up this fear that we have, and we are walking around constantly sort of charged with this fear. Next, please. And then finally, lament, which is really the only way we're going to get through this. But the problem is we are really, really bad at lamenting. We're really bad at dying. We do all sorts of things to sanitize and pretend that death doesn't actually happen. But admitting it and crying and journaling and talking and ritualizing is what the church needs to be about, to help people through this time of dying so we can get on to the next life. Next, please. So I believe that it is the church's current urgent mission to talk about and ritualize these Good Fridays of these common deaths that we are experiencing, and we need to do it for as long as it takes, until we are clear-hearted enough to rise again on Easter Sunday. I believe if we don't help people through this time, if we don't help them trust that there are worse things than dying, because there was always resurrection on the other side, if we don't do this work, we are really in trouble. So these are the storms that we are facing right now. These are the uncertain times. And we can preach into this to help them manage this time of uncertainty. So next, please. Questions?
Well, first I want to say that, Lisa, you've painted such a vivid picture of the environment that we're in now, the political, social, economic, psychological environment. And it seems fairly bleak. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of change, a lot of fear. I wonder, and we're waiting for some questions to come in from the audience, but I'm wondering, it seems to me that this would be generally accepted, that people would hear this and say, yes, I acknowledge that this is what's happening now. Are there people that, for them, this is not the reality, even though we acknowledge that this is what's true? And if so, what would you say to those people? How would you respond?
I don't think that people do acknowledge this is what's happening, which I think is part of the problem. I think this is why we are anxious to revive a mythologized past. I think this is why we can look at the number of deaths. I heard this on the radio again yesterday. A caller called in to a public radio and said 94% of all of the COVID deaths are due to comorbidities. Well, that didn't help, but it was a way to brush off the reality of, if you don't have a comorbidity, everything's fine. We as a culture are not good at acknowledging that things are passing away. And that's what makes this so hard right now, is so many things are passing away all at the same time. So I think that's part of what makes it very difficult.
Yes, we're seeing a convergence of all of these things happening at once in a way that is very intense, and in a way that's being experienced by all of us universally in some senses.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I've got a question from Lee, and Lee would like to know, how do we invite our congregations into lament when they are not used to doing this? We are entering All Saints and Advent. What are some of the ways we can introduce lament into these rituals? That's a great question.
Right. That is a very good question. And in some ways, I am going to deflect that that question because I really want to bring in the liturgists. I consider myself more of a preacher than a liturgist, and I think this is the work that we need to be doing together. That the leaders of the church and the true all of liturgical professors and so on, we need to be working on this together because we are not good at it. In the book, I talk about, I believe we need to riff off of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. I think we need to create, to form Truth and Lamentation Commissions. I think we as the church need to be bringing together conversations where we tell the truth, that we tell all the truth, that we listen, and we create those rituals of lamentation. But I see this as part of our future work, and it's going to take time because people aren't eager to go there.
It's a good challenge to us. Thomas would like to know, how do we move through these times? And before you answer, he follows up with, how does this seem like either a grassroots effort if it isn't driven through the church system? So it seems like either a grassroots effort if it isn't driven through the church system.
I think I'd love to get a little bit more on the question when you say, how do we move through? I would love to get a little bit more follow-up on quite what that means.
Well, let's give Thomas a chance to respond to that. Let's go to another question. One of my biggest concerns is that the church becomes irrelevant in all of this. How do we help that to not happen?
Oh, see, this is where, yes. And I think this is the time for us that we are more relevant now than we have probably in our lifetimes because we have the narrative. You know that someone is always going to tell a story. They're always going to try to fill in the gaps and create a narrative. But we as Christians have the narrative that resurrection always follows death. This is not the end of the story. But what we hear in the culture is, it is all doom and gloom, and it is the end of the story. And if you don't follow me, whoever me is, then everything really is going to fall apart. We know as Christians that that is not the case. In our narrative, resurrection always follows. And we have a reach because we are online now with church in a way that we have not been in times past. So for us to be amplifying that voice and amplifying this narrative is critically important and makes us the most relevant we've ever been.
That's great. Thank you, Lisa. Julie says, I really like the metaphor of the Holy Week we are living now. How can we look to transitioning this week in a non-Christian way? Is there an interfaith language you can share?
You know, that is a very good question. And I don't know off the top of my head, I would say it is absolutely the time to be gathering with interfaith partners. There are plenty of interfaith dialogue groups that most denominations have put together locally. And it is the time for us to be working together. The Christianity has, we have our narrative that resurrection happens, and we need to be in partnership with others who also know there is much for us to learn and be sharing stories with other denominations, with other faith traditions, to be able to help us with this time as well. So look to them.
Thanks. Christy says, I resonate with your comment that we mustn't sanitize lament. In a time of intentional sanitization, how can we use that term to wipe away pretenses for lament?
One of the most important ways, I would say, is by modeling. By naming the things that we are losing and that make us sad. One of the things that is so hard about this time, as I said, there are some things we have to lose. For example, white privilege. It's gotta go. But that doesn't mean for those of us who have enjoyed that white privilege, that there isn't going to be loss that comes with it. Now, I'm not saying that that's pretty. I'm not saying it's nice. I'm not saying it doesn't deserve to go. It does deserve to go. But we cannot risk shaming people for the losses they feel. I mean, we all probably learned in our pastoral care training, loss is loss and grief is grief. And it is individual to every person who experiences it. We always have to make sure that people have got a way back and a way through. And so there may be losses that some people experience that we find reprehensible, that we don't understand, that we just want to say, yeah, high time, and get over it. But that is not the way of resurrection and community and making sure people stay in the fold that we've got. So part of it is naming the truth of what are you losing, what makes you sad, what makes you hope, and how are you moving through it, both in ways to do that in sermons, as well as in conversation, what you do for your newsletter writings for your congregations, a lot of different ways to get that out there. But modeling, I would say, is one of the most important things we can do.
Thank you, Lisa. I did get a follow-up from Thomas. And Thomas says, trying to move through the stages of death, what we know is ending. We need to move through death to resurrection. How do we help make that move? That's a good clarification.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Perhaps the rest of the presentation will help answer that, because I'm going to talk specifically about the preaching task now and some ways that we can move through that.
We've got several more questions. Why don't we take one more and then we can go continue with the rest of the presentation. What does acknowledging the reality you have just described say to the conversation about preaching on justice-related issues? And maybe you're going to get to that.
I assume you mean that lamenting the things that we are genuinely lamenting. I'm interpreting it to refer to that.
I'm interpreting it to refer to that same as well. Matt can tell us if we've got it wrong, but I think so.
Okay. I think if we need to be acknowledging the full picture, that there are things that we will grieve to lose while we also know they have to be lost. Both of those things can be true at the same time. And I think if we acknowledge those things that we've got to give up that we don't want to, that is also going to be helping other people move through that, of understanding that our losses, though they may be painful and necessary, we can still go through them because that's what Jesus Christ promises.
I think at this point, why don't we continue with the presentation and then we can address the rest of the questions after you do the rest of your content. How does that sound, Lisa?
That sounds great. Okay. Good. Thank you. All right. So what I want to suggest then is that what makes for a challenging sermon, it's not because of the subject matter. It's because it threatens what a listener holds dear. It doesn't have to be rational. It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't even have to be something we're aware that we even said, which you may have experienced if you've had people who have come to you after a sermon and been upset with something that you said, and you're just like, but I never said that. I've had that happen literally. I never said that. And I can go back to the manuscript and prove I never said it. But it doesn't matter what I said. It's what they heard. It's what they perceived I said that threatened something that mattered to them. So the essence of a challenging sermon is when it is perceived to threaten what a listener holds dear. Next, please. So the essence of a challenging sermon and how we do this. Christianity is about losing our lives in order to find them. It is losing our lives for the sake of Christ, for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of another. So the ways we move through this are helping people trust the promises of Jesus Christ, letting things die, finding the courage it takes to lament, and then rising to new life. Next, please. So how do we do this? Four ways I'm going to suggest today. One is on building mutual trust. Another is empathizing, preaching scripture, not issues. And then finally, making dying to self sound irresistible. Next, please. So building mutual trust. Trust is everything. If we are asking people to do something this hard, like dying to self, then they need to trust that we have their best interests at heart. They also need to trust that God has their best interests at heart. There are three concrete ways to help you with building trust: reliability, competence, and sincerity. Reliability is being dependable. It's knowing that people can count on you to do the job you said you would do. Competent, do you have the ability, do you have the means and the capacity to do what you said you would? So for example, do you have the skill set? Do you have the resources? Do you have the time? So are you competent and able to carry out what you promise you will? And sincerity, do you mean what you say? Do you say what you mean? When we work on these three things about being reliable, being competent, and being sincere, so for example, if you say, I'm going to be taking my vacation time and I'm not available for the next week, but then you answer emails, that's something that can get people to wonder a little bit. If you say you're going to show up on time, but you don't, or if you are consistently showing up on time, if you take your vacation and you don't answer emails, people will learn, yep, you really mean it. You do what you say you're going to do, and you are competent at your job. There is a huge question also, though, about whether people trust God for exactly the same reasons. Is God reliable? Does God show up when God says God will? Can we count on God? So for example, having been through Hurricane Harvey here in the Houston, Texas metro a few years ago, there were a whole lot of questions in that moment. Could we count on God to show up? Was God competent? Does God actually have the capacity and the means to fulfill God's promises? So if we pray and ask God to do something and God doesn't follow through in the way we expect God to, in the picture with the picture we have in our heads about what that follow through looks like, then we wonder if God is competent. So is God competent to raise people from the dead? Does God really do that? Does God really reconcile us one to another? Is God really able to do those things? Those are questions people have. In addition, sincere, does God mean it? Does God mean, I forgive you everything? Does God mean it? Forgive 70 times 7. Does God mean it when God says, I love you? So when we as their preachers are telling people, yes, God loves you, they have to trust us, they have to trust God, and there has to be some measure of experience in their lives that will build on that to say, yes, I can trust. I can trust what my preacher is telling me. I can trust what God is telling me. So then if we go through this and tell people, yes, there is life at the other, on the other side of this. There is another life. Resurrection will happen. They have some reason to follow. Next, please. Empathize. This is so important. We need to get inside people's skins and imagine those things that I noticed, that I mentioned above, of well-being and livelihood and identity and all of the others. For them, what's at stake? What do they fear? Whom do they love? What do they believe they can't live without? What are they saying? I will only let X, Y, or Z change over my dead body. because something is so critical, so fundamental to who they understand themselves to be, they're saying, I won't live without it. There can't be another side of this story. So imagining for them what's at stake. The Beatitudes are coming up on All Saints Day. So many people are reacting to the Beatitudes, seeing that as a political ploy on the part of the preacher to be offering an agenda that the preach, it's just in the rota of the regularly scheduled readings. It's, we didn't pick it, and we're still being blamed for it as a political agenda. But why? Because something in those Beatitudes is feels threatening. Something they value is at stake. What might that be? Go through that list. And not only for what might be directly impacting them, but remember, your listeners live with people. So let's say, for example, you preach the most compelling, persuasive sermon of your life. And let's say the entire congregation raises up and claps and cheers and says, yes, I'm with you 100%. I got it. They might still have to go home and live with people who don't get it, or work with people who don't get it, or in a neighborhood who don't get it. Some of those relationships are going to be so critically important to them, they don't believe they can risk that relationship. And this isn't an us and them, this is all of us. We all have relationships. We all have things that we value so much, we won't put them at risk, which is why we all still need redemption. Empathize. What are they afraid to lose? What's at stake? What matters? Next, please. Preaching scripture rather than issues is another way through this. Jesus didn't try to, for example, get rid of the Romans out of Jerusalem. Jesus was concerned with the diseases of the human spirit and heal that. He was interested in healing the diseases of the human spirit that separate us from God and one another. So when we look at what's happening in our culture and the things that are so scary and the things that are changing, what's under that? What is the disease of the human condition manifested in the issue of the day? What are the fears? What's the desire for control? What does God do as revealed in a text to heal that disease? What is God doing? What is God's character that is addressing what is underneath the scriptures? That is underneath, rather, what is underneath the issues of the day that the scripture addresses? Then we can decide. Sometimes the best thing to do is to name that issue right out loud, put it on the table, and we're going to be talking about that in light of scripture. So the issue of the day is used as an example of the way that human disease is being manifested. Sometimes instead, we can draw a picture around it and not name it. And other times, we draw breadcrumbs. We drop those breadcrumbs. And if people can connect the dots, they will. If they can't, they won't. And probably our putting it in their faces isn't going to make a difference. If they can't hear it, they're not going to hear it. Those are all rhetorical decisions we need to make when we decide how to craft the sermon. But it's not preaching the issue. It's preaching what is in the human spirit that God is eager to heal. Next, please. And then making dying to self sound irresistible. Do we believe dying happens before resurrection? In other words, can everything just turn out okay without anything changing? Can everything turn out just the way we want it to without making any sacrifices to make it better? Do we trust that resurrection is a new and better life? Do we believe God has our best interests at heart and will lead us through whatever the changes are, whatever the changes that need to be made, especially for justice, for climate change, globalization, as people are moving around the globe. These are all changes that are happening and need to happen, and they're inevitable. They're absolutely inevitable. So do we believe that in the changes that we've got to go through, the things that have to die, that there is life on the other side? And do we believe Jesus was sincere when he said, if you want to lose your life, if you want to save your life, you got to lose it? That's how it works. That's how it works. But because there is another side, painting that picture of what a newly reborn, an earth on the other side of climate change is probably going to, if we do it well, is going to be better than what we've got right now. A life, painting that picture of a life when systems support all people, not based on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character, paint that picture. It is better than the way we are living now. It is the way that God intends it to be. Paint the picture. Paint the picture of resurrection, that people want to go there rather than stay where we are. And that is what will bring us through these times. All right, questions. Back again.
We've got four queued up right now, and I'm going to start with the one about death and resurrection. I know you've said a bit more about this. Natalie says, resurrection is the hope of those who have lost, and I see resurrection as the hope, and just wants you to address that a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely. There are ways each of us can look to our lives to be able to see the things and the time and the pain that we thought we could never get through. We probably would never want to go through it again. We wouldn't choose to go through it. And yet, the way that we came through that and the way that life became better because we were living congruently with God shows us we can trust in a hope that is yet to come. It's not one that we can just sort of have wishful thinking about it. This is being a part of the Christian life, is to bring it about. This is what it means to build the reign of God on this earth right now, not pie in the sky, but it can happen right now when we are a part of building it.
Very helpful. Amy has a question about burnout. How do we not burn out in preaching about COVID and sheltering at home? I feel like I've been in a loop about preaching about the situation we find ourselves in. And I'm sure Amy's in good company there.
Oh, yes. Yes. Everybody needs a break now and then. I think none of us can deal with the same subject matters over and over and over again. So looking to the scriptures and finding additional things that the scriptures address, if it is true that God is healing the human condition and bringing us closer to God, there are always additional things that we can talk about that, even if it's sort of tangentially related to some of the issues of the day, we will still be moving forward on all of those, because if we're preaching faith and hope and life and love and reconciliation, it kind of touches on everything all the time.
Thank you. Julie has a question about the balance of lament. And Julie likes to look at the Psalms to better understand lament. And we do need to spend a lot of time on sad songs, but eventually we have to move to songs of praise. So the question is, how do we determine when to pepper in the praise and move away from lament? Is it possible to spend too much time in lament?
My first response is to think, I'm not sure we've tried it yet. I'm not sure that we have gotten to a place where we are willing yet to admit that the times as we have known it are over. So the first thing would be, I'd want to try it and see what happens. And then the next part of it is to look at, in the book I talk about some very, very specific ways to look at the congregation to determine its capacity to talk about difficult things. How brittle or how resilient is the congregation? How much can they take? And a part of it is also, how much can you take? Because this, all the stuff that I've described are having an impact on us as much as they are having an impact on those we serve. We have to decide also what is our capacity to be preaching on lament or preaching on praise, that we all have to have a balance. And which raises one thing I implore upon all of my colleagues, and that is to have a great deal of respect and trust in one another, because we don't know what another person is going through as a preacher. We don't know what they're facing. We don't know their congregations. We don't know what their capacity is to deal with the difficulties of the moment. A very brittle congregation who is at loggerheads with each other is going to have less capacity for hard work than other congregations that are in a better place. And likewise, those who are kind of cruising along, they might need to be their chains yanked a little bit for a little more of a reality check that it's not all sunshine and roses out there. Judging the capacity of our congregations is critically important for them to hearing the gospel. So to be gentle and respectful and trust each other, that we are making the best decisions we can with what we've got to work with, and to support each other in the ways that each of us is doing that, because we need each other. We need each other as preachers, and can't afford to alienate each other by deciding what somebody else should or shouldn't be preaching or how.
Very well said. Thank you, Lisa. Someone wants to hear a story that you could share, which paints the picture of dying to self en route to the kingdom of God breaking through. It would help this person hear you bring some of the abstract principles into the flesh.
Okay. I think one of the absolute best depictions of a resurrected life on the other side is actually not literally a sermon, but Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. When he talked about, I have a dream that one day people will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And then he went on to describe a classroom and what he hoped his children would grow up into. It painted such a vivid picture of the way that we could be living, that made us see that the strife of the time and the tremendous turmoil and angst of the day did have another side to it. So, for example, if I were to put that into contemporary terms, I think a lot about how it was already a problem with the pre-pandemic, it's worse now, with the disparity in education systems across the United States. So imagine a country in which every single kid graduates from high school. Imagine what it would be like if every single human being in this country were able to achieve the capacity of their gifts and talents and hopes and dreams. What would that do to the fabric of our expertise across the country? So by painting a picture of what would it look like, but putting it into real concrete terms, it can help us envision what it would look like and realize that there is a way between here and there, and the pain of getting from here to there is going to be worth it, whatever it takes, because that's better than the way things are right now. So the more concrete you can put it into what would it be like if, the better off your sermons can be.
Thank you, Lisa. We've got one more really good question, but I think I know that you have a little more content that you wanted to go through, unless you felt you could address one more question very briefly.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, we're going to end on this one. I've heard quite often in my context, if I die, I die. If it's my time to die, I'm not going to do it in fear regarding COVID. So how do you see us engaging this conversation around death in this particular time where literal death is very real and people are using it as a reason to act in self-serving ways? This is so important right now.
That is a great question. So I was just thinking about this because I was just rereading the story of the rich young man. And remember how he goes to Jesus and he says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus's response gets to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and your neighbor like yourself. When the rich young man asked that question, he was asking, how do I save my eternal neck? It was all about him. Jesus's response was, it's not at all about you. This is about other people. We live in a transactional culture, and that includes church. People go to church and church shop based on what's in it for me. The question of Christianity is not what's in it for me that I am a follower of Jesus Christ. It's what's in it for you that I am a follower of Jesus Christ. What's in it for you? I think if we can start reframing and asking that question anew, then masks get to be one of those, that's a breadcrumb dropping moment. When we start bringing up this question, what's in it for you that I am a follower of Jesus Christ? Then we can start to see, oh, maybe one of those things would be, I will protect you from a virus that I could be carrying.
That is so beautifully stated. Thank you. I feel like that's the perfect place to end on that note. Really appreciate that. I know you have a little more content. So Ben, if you wouldn't mind pulling up the rest of her slides, thank you.
Great, thanks. Just a couple of things for you that you can continue on with. The book is available and there's a lot more practical advice in there. And then the last slide, please, Ben. There's also, I write a blog every week and I do things like this 10 ways to improve your sermon by Sunday with very practical tips. And I think Ben is going to lift that link and put it into the chat. And feel free to sign up for the newsletter and be part of Backstory Preaching in addition to Faith Lead. And my entire ministry is helping you in your ministry as a preacher. That is all I do, is to support you as a preacher. And it would be my honor to continue to do that after this conversation. So thank you all very much for being a part of this. Feel free to reach out to me anytime. Thank you to Faith Lead, Ben, Tessa, Dr. Moore. Thank you very much for having me. It was a privilege.